I'm John Weber, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Dave Heller has the evening off. South Jersey Republican Congressman Tom MacArthur is the author of the compromise that has breathed new life into the GOP's effort to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. The amended legislation allows states to get waivers for things like covering pre-existing conditions. It's winning converts from very conservative Republicans, but drawing opposition from moderate lawmakers from our region. WHYY's Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo reports.
Congressman MacArthur is a straightforward Republican. He never dodges questions, and you always know what's on his mind, likely to the chagrin of party leaders. But he's only been in Congress for two terms, so he usually doesn't garner that much attention. This week was different. After he forged a compromise with members of the Conservative House Freedom Caucus on a health care overhaul, he was the hottest ticket in town. There were 10 reporters waiting for him when he went into the members-only men's room off the House floor.
Yeah, not gonna follow me in here. See y'all.
When he exited the restroom, he came over to talk to WHYY, and soon 26 reporters were thrusting microphones in his face.
But you put a bunch of Tuesday group members in a tough position. Are they?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
So how did he win over that big voting bloc that had been unwilling to endorse the old version of the bill because it did not go far enough? MacArthur, a former insurance company CEO, says during Congress's two-week Easter recess, he kept negotiations going.
So it really came out of those meetings before the break that the vice president was leading. And I think some good ideas came out of that just never coalesced into a proposal, and so I put pen to paper.
But MacArthur is known as a moderate, and now he's teamed up with the far right wing of his party to forge ahead on what polls have shown as an unpopular health reform effort. Is he putting his seat at risk?
Well, I am not looking at this through a political lens. We have a health care crisis in this country that has to get solved. And right now, as we speak, 23 million Americans do not have insurance, and millions more are relying on insurance in a system that is slowly collapsing. Every day, insurers are leaving. My home state had 6 health insurers 18 months ago. Now we have 2. A third of counties have 1. And in spite of that, Americans' healthcare insurance costs are skyrocketing.
MacArthur's amendment opens the door for states to opt out of things like forcing insurance companies to provide maternity leave and cancer treatment without jacking up the prices for them. They would still be offered coverage, but critics say those offers ring hollow if the premiums are unaffordable. MacArthur says the amendment is necessary because the current system, with premiums rising for everyone, is unsustainable.
And that's what my amendment is trying to get at. How do we do these two things? Help those that are in need, make sure every American has insurance, and at the same time make sure the costs are under control.
Ironically, his plan is not playing well with moderate Republicans in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. Leonard Lance represents a district just north of MacArthur's.
I am opposed to the bill, and I think the Democrats should come to the table on the issue of the exchanges, which I think is an area that needs reform immediately.
Lance says he still doesn't think the bill will work.
I want to vote for a proposal that lowers premiums for the American people, and I don't think this bill does that.
Congressman Ryan Costello, who represents parts of 4 counties west of Philadelphia, is not sold either.
My principles have always been making sure that we have affordable access to coverage for all Americans, and I believe that the pre-existing conditions protection should be without contingency. And so it's for those reasons.
Republican Congressman Pat Meehan from the neighboring 7th District also says he's against the plan. Still, MacArthur says he's actively lobbying his skeptical colleagues to get on board.
We have a job to do as Congress. Ideally, we should be doing things, both Republicans and Democrats. On this particular bill, it's going to be an all-Republican effort. And so I simply am looking at which Republicans can we get to support a compromise that is helpful for moving along health care reform, which is desperately needed.
At one point, there was talk about a vote on the amended bill this week, but that got put off. When the original bill was scheduled for a vote and then tabled, it was because both the Freedom Caucus and many moderate Republicans lined up against it. It's unclear if Republicans can get it through the House if one of those camps votes against it. Regardless of the outcome, MacArthur is now tied to the plan in a way that will likely be part of any Democratic candidate's campaign against him in 2018. For WHYY News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
There are 2 versions of the NFL draft. And there's the raucous, festive version that took place on the Art Museum steps that you've been hearing about all week. Then there's the version playing out in living rooms across the country as nervous college prospects learn where they'll be drafted or if they'll be drafted at all. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt introduces us to one of those prospects as he gets ready for a life-changing announcement.
It's hard to tell if Julian Davenport is more David or Goliath. The Goliath part is pretty obvious. Davenport is an offensive tackle at Bucknell University in central Pennsylvania, and he is biblically big. His coach, Joe Susan, draws a picture.
He's a full 6'6 and three quarters. He's a lean 318 pounder.
Even in a world of large men, Davenport is exceptionally large.
I don't look up in terms of, to many people, he's one of the guys that as soon as you meet him, you're going to say, he's a little bit taller than I thought he'd be.
That size and Davenport's athleticism has made him a major NFL prospect. Prognosticators tend to think he'll be drafted somewhere around the third or fourth round. And then there's the David side of Davenport, a kid so unassuming people don't even know how to spell or say his name.
So first name is actually pronounced Julion, and it's an accent mark over the E, and it's not an apostrophe after the E.
Somewhere along the way, someone decided Julian should be spelled with an apostrophe between the E and the N instead of an accent mark over the E. You'll find this spelling all over the internet and even on Bucknell's official website.
I didn't make it a big deal. Just let it ride and, you know, thought maybe their software couldn't put the accent mark over the E.
Even if people did spell Julian correctly, Davenport wouldn't be a household name. Bucknell is a small school in a small conference. Davenport landed there partly because he didn't know a whole lot about college recruiting. The Bison haven't had a player drafted into the NFL since 1969. It'll be on Davenport, the big man from the little school, to break that streak. First, though, Davenport has to finish his schoolwork. On Wednesday morning, he crisscrosses Bucknell's campus to find a printer where he can fire off a term paper on the Patriot Act. Then he hand-delivers that paper to a poli-sci professor. It is a strikingly familiar college sequence, almost tender in its normalcy. But things are about to change for Davenport. Tonight, he will gather with friends and family at his dad's house in Blackwood, New Jersey, to watch the second and third rounds of the NFL draft. And if he isn't taken then, they'll hold their breath and watch again Saturday.
Like, everybody asks me this all the time, like, hey, are you nervous and all, and I mean, it's just my nature, I would say. I just get more anxious, I would say, than nervous.
He says there's a difference. Nervous means you're dreading what might happen. Anxious means you're looking forward to it. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
WHYY will be watching the draft this weekend through Julian Davenport's eyes. We'll report back on Monday how it went. President Donald Trump's tax reform proposal dramatically diminishes the burden for businesses. In this week's edition of What Are We Thinking? Newsworks Tonight's Dave Heller sits down with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll, to gauge public opinion on cuts for corporations.
Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
The intent is to cut the corporate tax rate by more than half. Does that please the public?
No, it doesn't. When we test various things relating to who should get tax cuts and who shouldn't, corporations are near the bottom of the list. A couple of different ways we measure that. We know that Americans right now think that corporations don't pay enough in taxes rather than too much. And as mentioned, when we say, do you favor or oppose giving tax cuts to the following, the corporations are at the bottom of the list. People go along with lower income and middle income tax cuts. They actually like that. That's near the top of the list of what Americans want. But not cuts in taxes for corporations.
So the public has a hard time drawing that straight line from corporate tax cuts to businesses booming and companies hiring.
If that's what Trump and the Republicans want to argue, they're going to have to draw that line with a little firmer felt-tip pen so that Americans see the connection, because right now they don't.
I understand Gallup tested the public's rating of Trump on several economic dimensions.
That's right. Now that 100 days are essentially up as of Saturday, we thought we would test what the public thinks about how he's done on various aspects of the economy, things that he promised that he would do. He gets best credit for preventing companies or factories from relocating overseas. That's at the top of the list, a net positive. More Americans said he's done an excellent or good job on that than a poor job. And also the other one out of the six that we tested that's above water, that Americans are more positive than negative about, is cutting regulations on businesses, which he issued an executive order to do just that. The things that Americans don't give him credit for are tax reform. Now, again, these data are from a week ago, so it's before any new tax reform packages have really been put out there, but they give him low credit for that, and also don't give him a lot of credit for reducing federal spending or for improving trade policies with other countries.
In an overall sense, is Trump given credit for making correct decisions on the economy?
Well, we have asked for each of the last three presidents. That would be George W. Bush and for Barack Obama, and now for Donald Trump in April of their first year. Actually, we asked this in April of every year since George W. Bush took office. How much confidence do you have in them to make the right decisions on the economy? And Trump does worse than his two predecessors. About 48%, half of Americans say they have a great deal or a fair amount of confidence in Trump to make the right decisions on the economy. But Obama was up at 71%. And remember, back in 2009, this was April of 2009 we're talking about, Obama had high job approval ratings, was still riding the crest of very positive feelings, so he got a lot of credit for that. But George Bush, who came in 2001, in April of that year, he had almost as much, about two-thirds of Americans, giving him credit for making the right decisions on the economy. So in terms of where they started out, Trump is starting out significantly below his two predecessors in terms of the public's confidence that they're able to handle the economy.
So if Donald Trump hypothetically made an appeal to pollsters and said, I want to be in sync with American priorities, what might he do?
Well, that would be nice if he did that, wouldn't it? At least I think it would be, because as we've talked about and I've written about many times over the years, I think leaders would do well to pay attention to the collective wisdom of the public.
That's the essence of populism.
I'm a little more confident in the people than a lot of our leaders, so I do think leaders should pay attention to the people. But if Trump was to follow what the public wants, he would first of all pay close attention to small businesses. That comes up at the top of everything we look at, not big businesses or corporations, but small businesses. He would, as he's promised he would, pay a lot of attention to veterans. He would spend huge amounts of money, agree on an infrastructure plan. Americans clearly like that. He would give parental leave to American working families. The public really likes that. He would also pass tax cuts for lower and middle income people.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
Well, it's one thing to go to the zoo with your family to enjoy the spring weather, but the experience is totally different when you're a teacher taking your class on a field trip, especially when you realize the problem is not the kids or the animals. That's Jason Pittman's story in this edition of WHYY's Common Space titled, When Teachers Tell All.
So I have just completed 10 years as a public school teacher in Washington, D.C. Actually, please don't clap. Don't clap, actually, because I just quit. It was a difficult decision. I hated leaving a lot of my students. I had a student when I was a very young teacher, Brian, in the middle of my lessons, would conduct these very wild conversations between his thumbs, who spoke their own thumb language, like, me, 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 me. Me, 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 me. So when Ryan's mother signed up to be the chaperone of our class field trip to the zoo, I was unhappy. She gets the kids. We get to the zoo. She walks 20 steps from the entrance. She sits down next to the ice cream vending machine, plops herself down, buys herself an ice cream, announces to the three students that I have conservatively put in her chaperoning group, it's too hot to walk around the zoo today, and just eats ice cream in front of the children and won't buy them any. I find out about this when I was summoned by the zoo staff to the petting area of the zoo because my students from her group have decided to ride the goats. Now, look, I love my students, so I have to justify their behavior a little bit. These are boys who have eaten all of the soap in the soap dispenser in my classroom. So, like, wanting to ride a totally awesome miniature horse, double unicorn pony is, like, the most well-behaved and normal thing that they've done this year. Look, as a parent chaperone on a school field trip, you have one job, and that is returning to the school with the same number of uninjured children that you started with. We get on the subway, the metro in D.C., the doors close, and Mrs. Hannigan, Ryan's mother, says to me, "Beth and Pitt, but I don't think I have all the kids in my class. I know I'm not supposed to make fun of the parents, but I just quit." So I said, "Mrs. Hannigan, please count to three and tell me that you have all of the students in your group." After she gets to two and pauses, I realize we are missing a child, and of course, it's Thumbs. She left her own child in the subway station on the last platform. I pull the whole class off the subway, ride back to the other one, pick him up, bring him. Mrs. Hannigan, however, is not the criminal element of this story, is not the worst chaperone of this story. Because the worst parent chaperone this day got arrested. Mr. shows up at the last minute asking to be a parent chaperone. I'm not sure we're going to let dad who just got out of jail be the chaperone for a group of kids, but I tell him, sure, have a little father-son day with your kid. Decides it'll be super entertaining to encourage the monkeys to throw their poo at each other. Causes such a ruckus that he's escorted out by the zoo security. Turns out he has outstanding warrants and is arrested. His son has to walk by himself 10 miles from the police station home that night. It was situations and students like that that kept me in teaching and wanting to be a better teacher for kids like that. It was the adults and the parents and the administrators and the legislators that drove me out.
Storyteller Jaceman Pittman in the Teachers Tell All edition of Common Space, a collaboration of First Person Arts and WHYY. You can hear more stories this Sunday night at 8 o'clock and anytime online at acommonspace.org. Tomorrow is Independent Bookstore Day, when small brick-and-mortar booksellers around the country and the people that love them celebrate new reading material. This year, 15 local bookstores have banded together to promote each other with a game. WHYY's Peter Cremins reports.
After the advent of big box stores and online retail giants, small independent bookstores learned to survive not by selling you the book you want, but by selling you the book you didn't know you wanted.
It's so great. It's so well written. And it's really good. Yeah. You want it?
Sure. The staff at Joseph Fox Booksellers in Philadelphia's Rittenhouse Square offer advice to adventurous readers. Co-owner Judy Fox says bookstores in Philadelphia tend to send customers to their competition if they don't have exactly the right book.
We're all in the same business of showing people books that maybe they may not be deliberately looking for, but as you browse around a store, you see beautiful, unusual books that you may not have even thought of to just open your horizons. We're all trying to do the same thing, and so we all work together to do it.
That sense of business camaraderie is codified this year for Independent Bookstore Day. Joseph Fox, which has been family-owned for 66 years, joined 14 other bookstores in the region to cross-promote one another. They're collaborating on a scavenger hunt. People are given a map to all 15 bookstores in the greater Philadelphia region, from New Hope to Doylestown to Exton to downtown Philadelphia. Each store puts a stamp on the map that makes you eligible for prizes. Those who visit all of them in one day are eligible for the grand prize, lunch with a selected local author. This collaborative effort is spearheaded by Lynn Rosen, a relative newcomer to the retail business. She opened Open Book Bookstore in Elkins Park just 2 years ago, and she says the reports on the death of independent bookstores are greatly exaggerated.
The tide is shifting a little bit, and people are starting to realize what they've lost with the predominance of these uniform big box stores. There's a personal touch that we get to know you. People come in and talk. A lot of what we do is not just selling books, but it's conversation around books that we're providing.
Lynn says the inspiration for this collaboration came from Seattle, where customers are encouraged to visit 17 local stores on Independent Bookstore Day, including one shop accessible only by ferry. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Banyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Our engineer is Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm John Weber for NewsWorks Tonight.